Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering. We're here with another fun-filled show, and today we've got all sorts of stuff. We've got superpowers, no superpowers, Shakespeare powers, and all sorts of... I am Rob, and I will be your co-pilot today. Our main pilot is Andrew.
Which, like all pilots, I am horrifically drunk at the moment.
Yes, he is.
So I really wonder what Shakespeare powers are now.
Super Shakespeare powers. We will get to those later.
Oh, yes. Yes, we will.
Yes, we will. And I'm not talking about the fact that Shakespeare has stamps now to celebrate his 400th, the anniversary of his death. I don't understand this whole thing. It's 400 years since Shakespeare died. Let's have a celebration. What? Did we hate him? No, we loved him. So why not celebrate the anniversary of his birth?
That would make too much sense, Rob.
Do you see what I mean? We have Christmas to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and then there's the whole, you know, dying and coming back from the grave.
Yeah, but I feel like that's an exception because he got better.
Yeah, I know. He kind of, it's weird how that works. You know, whatever medication he took to recover from death, I want some of that.
I think it's actually a mistranslation of the Bible.
What?
See, after he was crucified, Jesus was only mostly dead. Until his friends had to take him to see Magic Max.
No, it was Miracle Max.
Miracle Max.
Yes.
Oh,
who kept saying to blave, which means to bluff. He was playing cards. And then his wife comes out and starts going, liar! You set me up on Princess Bride.
I did set you up on Princess Bride.
If only Shakespeare had written The Princess Bride. Or did he?
No, he can't have done. If he had have, that would have been inconceivable.
Yes, it could have been.
Yeah. And we can move on now because I've mentioned inconceivable.
Yes. I was waiting for you. I was trying to cue it up. Anyway, let's start off with the news. So, what have we got?
Well, first up, we have got a bit of a stark contrast to the Bad Sex Awards, which we covered a few weeks ago.
Yes.
This is a new prize by the Literary Hub to find the best erotic passage. What possible problem could you have with erotic passage? Please explain that on our family friendly all ages show.
Sorry, I just no, I'm not going to say anything about starfish corridors or anything like that.
Oh no.
Oh, sorry, I just did.
So anyway, no, Oracle, I don't want to update. I'm trying to do the news. Anyway, the winner was from James Baldwin's novel Giovanni's Room.
Giovanni's what?
Giovanni's Room.
I was worried what you said there because you kind of trailed off.
I did. I had like a mouth spasmy thing for some reason.
Better a mouth spasm than a Batman bladder spasm.
Yes. No one's a Batman bladder spasm. Like, Giovanni's Room tells the story of David, a young American Paris, who has just proposed to his girlfriend, but is drawn to bartender Giovanni while she is away on a trip. The winning extract deals with narrator David's early homosexual encounter with his friend Joey. Shall I read it?
Is it safe for work?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, we're all going to get a bit hot under the collar, I'm sure.
Okay.
But there's definitely nothing bad here. So, Joey raised his head as I lowered mine and we kissed, as it were, by accident. Then for the first time in my life, I was really aware of another person's body, of another person's smell. We had our arms around each other. And then this is the sexy bit. To remember it so clearly, so painfully tonight, tells me that I have never for an instant truly forgotten it. I feel in myself now a faint, a dreadful stirring of what so overwhelmingly stirred in me then. Great thirsty heat and trembling, and tenderness so painful that I thought my heart would burst. But out of this astounding, intolerable pain came joy. We gave each other joy that night. It seemed then that a lifetime would not be long enough for me to act with Joey the act of love. I didn't burst out laughing, I'm proud.
Do you know... Yes, okay, it's cheesy as hell, but compared to Morrissey,
It's suddenly no roller coaster of sexual violence.
Oh, no, 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 no. And things like a bashing about the head and...
Oh, this barrel roll over his chest. Yes.
And...
It's just like a little slippy toad piloting a...
Sorry, that was my Muttley laugh. I don't understand where the Muttley laugh comes from. It just comes... and goes like the Hurried Lover. So much better than the Morrissey one. And I'm going to leave it at that before I say something that incriminates me.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Oh, no.
Oh.
I've read what The Contender was.
Oh.
It's from a thing where it doesn't say what the author was, but the book is Written on the Body.
The book is called Written on the Body.
Yep.
Right.
I just
okay.
Wait for this, Rob. She smells of the sea. She smells rock pools when I was a child. She keeps a starfish in there. I crouch down to taste the salt, to run my fingers around the rim. She opens and shuts like a sea anemone. She's filled each day with the fresh tides of longing. Like a sea anemone. I've actually killed Rob.
If you could have seen my face... It looked like Pob. You know the old Channel 4 puppet thing?
Yeah.
With the inflated cheeks? I was trying so hard not to laugh.
Oh, by Jeanette Winterson. That's who that was by.
There's a starfish in the rock pool, is there?
Yeah.
I can understand why that first section won. If that was the competition.
Yeah, that's...
Sorry, but what was it? Jeanette Winterson?
Yeah, Jeanette Winterson.
I honestly think that's on a par, almost. It's not quite as bad as Morrissey, but it's heading in that direction.
It is. I mean, she opened and closed like a sea anemone.
She smells like the sea. Immediately I'm thinking the wrong thing.
Because nothing says sexy like brine.
Or fish. Not going there. Not going there.
No, I'm actually disappointed I didn't finish the Cthulhu book in time for today, because that's very Lovecraftian.
He smelled of the sea. His tentacles. I can't continue.
In the throes of passion, she moaned, Io, Cthulhu for Targan.
Yes.
I think I'm going to make it my life's work to make sexy Lovecraft a thing.
It must be done. I know hundreds of Japanese fans who'd eat that kind of stuff up. It's everything they want. It's everything they want, isn't it?
It's got tentacles. It's got cosmic horror. It's got sexy times.
Yes. Everything they want. Everything a growing boy needs.
Oh, no.
Anyway, shall we move on?
Let's move back into nice, safe-for-work territory.
Yes, the safe-for-work territory is that Shakespeare, not only is he getting stamps to celebrate his death, which even now is still an odd, odd thing to do, but they also found his first folio on the Scottish Isle of Bute, in a manor house in the Scottish island of Bute. It's a copy of Shakespeare's first folio, one of the most sought-after books in the world, and the copy is of the first collected edition of Shakespeare's plays, and it was published in 1623, and it was found at Mount Stuart House, and academics who authenticated the book called it a rare and significant find. About 230 copies of the first folio are known to exist. A copy owned by Oxford University sold for $3.5 million in 2003, which means that this one is going to be worth way more than that. And I remember seeing the article about the woman who actually found this, and she was just going through various things in the house, and there was a box that just said Shakespeare. That's all it said. And there was various things in there. And then she lifted out the folio and she goes, hang on. Oh, wait. Whoa, 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 whoa. 1623. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
So the first folio that's been lost for all these years was in a box marked Shakespeare.
Yes.
That's... Wow.
It's just kind of... That's like Scooby-Doo level of detective work. So we're looking for a lost Shakespeare. Maybe we should try in the box marked Agatha Christie.
See, Agatha Christie, we've got Jane Austen. Oh, what's this box? Shakespeare? Well, that's not going to be any help.
No, it's not Shakespeare, it's Shakespeare.
Oh, famous French author Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, no, it could have been the famous Zulu author. Shakespeare. Yeah. Oh, no. Shakespeare
of outrageous fortune.
Yeah, Shakespeare of outrageous fortune.
That was a fancy literary reference.
Yes, it was.
I'm well proud.
Yes. We'll get the slings and arrows thrown at us.
Indeed we will.
Like some crazy Latino wife who's found out her husband's cheating on her.
I was just throwing everything about.
Yep. Because slings and arrows don't make sense.
Yeah, because a sling isn't a projectile. It's a method of chucking a projectile.
If it said rocks or stones and arrows, then I'd understand that phrase. You know, but slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Everything else is fine. I just have a problem with the slings and the arrows. Slings and bows? Yeah, fine. Rocks and arrows, stones and arrows, I'm totally fine with. Hell, if you go a bit mechanized and you have bolts and arrows for crossbows, you know, or bows and crossbows, slings and crossbows, rocks and bolts, it all works.
Yeah. Or we could have like contemporary heavy machine gun fire of outrageous fortune.
Yeah.
So yeah, today on the Geek Show, Shakespeare. Bit rubbish, wasn't he?
Yeah, the arbalests and trebuchets of outrageous fortune. Let's just scale it up. Let's just go for the whole thing. Or what was that massive aircraft carrier called? The one that the United States have, like the USS whatever it is.
Oh, like the AC-130s, like the big gunship thing.
Yeah, the AC-130s. we're repurposing it for the modern era.
It's the rocket launchers and napalm.
Yes. So yeah, they found the first Shakespeare folio.
Hooray!
And we're back on track. Moving on to something a little bit different. You know how people with too much time on their hands can get into all sorts of bother?
Especially when they're scientists.
Especially when they're scientists. Well, this is Dr. Simon Park, I believe it is, and he has far too much time on his hands. He's a fan of Charles Darwin, we know that. He's a senior lecturer in molecular biology at Surrey University, and that just goes to show that lecturers at university have far too much time on their hands and you're not making them work enough. We've been to university, we know the truth.
Yes, we do.
So he's got too much time on his hands. And what does he do with free time? Does he do something constructive? Does he advance research and scientific purpose?
Does he just have reasonable office hours that means students can actually go talk to him?
No. None of the above. Instead, he's in some lab somewhere, we're not sure where, and he curates this thing called SeaMold. It's the world's largest collection of microorganisms for use in the arts.
Mold to be used in the arts.
And he believes that On the Origin of Species is the world's first bacteria-grown book. And so far, he's only created the first page, which took a little under 2 weeks, but he has plans to create a longer version. This is kind of the definition of too much time on your hands. Number one, bacteria for the purposes of art. Why?
Who even knows with that anymore?
Number two, The Origin of Species made from bacteria. Would you read it?
No, I feel like I would be pretty much the five-year-old girl and that's now it's pretty good. It's got germs.
Can you imagine the hand sanitizer? Right, are you ready to read The Origin of Species? Yeah, sure. Just washing my hands, hand sanitizer. Right, I'm ready. No, he's destroying the book.
Which That would be really cool. Like, just touch the book, it just dissolves.
Like you've got some weird superpower.
Is that what the Shakespeare power is?
Yes. Or you could have Domestos Man.
Yeah.
So we meet again, my old nemesis.
It's Professor Seamold. The nefarious plan to make a book out of bacteria has been foiled. Bonk.
Yes. By Domestos Man. Domestos Man's a killer. He kills 99.9% of all germs and bacteria.
Oh my god, he is. He's worse than, like, Man of Steel Superman.
Yeah, I mean, he should be on trial for, like, genocide. He's killed millions, man. Millions, I tell you.
Actually, have you seen how, like, completely messed up the Domestos adverts are?
Yes.
So you get, like, these little CGI germs, and they have personalities. They have lives.
Oh, no, that's not the worst one. The worst one is the Gaviscon advert.
Oh, with the tiny firemen inside your mouth.
Yes, spraying their...
spraying their hoses all about the place. Because I bet they have a copy of Giovanni's Room in the back pocket.
Yes. So, yeah, the first time I saw the Gaviscon advert, I thought, never, ever am I taking any Gaviscon. Where's that Pepto-Bismol?
Like, I'm pretty sure it doesn't help by the fact they've got, like, What a Feeling playing in the background.
I know. And, I mean, if you're going to have any sort of thing, just basically do it in the scientific way. Don't have tiny little firemen spraying their hoses of Milky Way liquid down someone's throat.
Yeah.
Because when you phrase it like that, it's a whole different meaning.
I mean, that makes it kind of worse than just the literal genocide of domestic adverts.
Yes. Although Domestos did do... No, it wasn't Domestos. It was... I think it was Dettol. They had those wipes. Had an interesting advert where you had some guy with glasses and he was basically a Buddhist. And he was, you know, he very gently lifts up the fly and puts it out the room. And then he decides to sneeze and he sneezes into one of these antibacterial napkins. And then he starts feeling guilty because he's just killed some germs. And I thought, that's a beautiful advert. Really simple. And if you understand it, you get the joke.
Because Dettol, your religion is a lie.
Yes. Anyway, so, Origin of Species, bacteria version. I'm not sold on this.
No, I mean, being generous, maybe it's going to help work out how to grow bacteria quicker.
Why?
For art.
Okay.
And more importantly, so that eventually we can build a giant bacteria man, thus forcing America to finally get off their butts and build the mechs that they've been promising.
I know what it
in
is.
In my imagination.
No, it's a secret plan to get rid of modern art. It's a secret plan to get rid of modern art. See, what they do, they're basically, at Seamold, what they're doing, they're training these bacteria, right, to basically work for artists. But what they're going to do, they're going to, at some point, sneak in these dangerous bacteria, like E. coli or Ebola or something like that, and it's going to be in there with the normal bacteria, and these modern artists are going to go, we can make art from bacteria. Let's go crazy. You know, let's go fun. Let's go do all the modern art things that we do. And then they're going to contract all these horrible, horrible germs and diseases from these bacteria.
You say that like there aren't artists weird enough to just build Ebola structures. Like you don't even need to lie to them. Just like, oh, yeah, this is some Ebola. I'm going to make a sculpture.
I'm going to be famous because I'm going to die while making it. Damn it. Great.
Because then it'll be like more money.
I had a really good conspiracy theory going on there, and you popped it by telling
me. No, new conspiracy theory.
Oh?
It's the art agents who are behind it all. Because then the artists will die whilst making their work, and so all the work will instantly become really expensive.
Yes, it will. Valid. Valid hypothesis.
We know what you're up to, art world.
Yes, we know. Anyway, let's move on to Harry Potter.
Yes, Harry Potter.
And J.K. Rowling's chair got sold for £278,000, raising all sorts of money for charity and for the auctions. Because the auction house takes like 10%, doesn't it?
Yeah, her chair.
The chair that she used to write The Philosopher's Stone.
Well, no, she didn't use it to... She sat in it whilst she wrote it.
Yeah, so someone's a fan of J.K. Rowling's,
like,
posterior.
This chair is not an integral part of the podcast.
Podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, right, yes. I was going to say.
I could sit in a different chair and still do the same podcast.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that she didn't sit exclusively in that chair. She probably moved around the house a little bit, having written, both you and I, having written stuff ourselves. We've moved around the house a little bit while writing. I'm pretty sure that you've done it as well.
Yeah, no, at no point have I thought, oh, I need to do some writing quickly to the ideas chair.
Yeah, because ideas stem from the butt. Which is why you must have extremely comfy chair and slack pants.
Oh, no, surely you need like a really uncomfortable chair so that through that you can write like the greatest drama ever made.
No, it has to be really comfortable and you need the slack pants because this has actually been proven, right? When you have a full bladder, your brain goes into like this hyper mode and you start rattling off all sorts of stuff really quickly because of the tension in the bladder. And as long as you maintain that tension, right, then your productivity goes way, way, way up. The ideas come thick and fast. And that's why you need the slack pants, because if you have tight pants, you need to go to the toilet. But if you've got slack pants, then you can let it build and you can actually write faster and have better ideas.
That's a thing.
I did not make that up. That is actually a real thing.
I don't think I like science anymore.
Let's put it this way. It's so real, they actually had it on the Big Bang Theory.
That's Big Bang Theory, though.
Yeah, I know, but I actually checked it. It's a real thing.
Oh.
Well, I saw a Big Bang Theory. I thought, that can't be true. And then I checked and went, it is true. Oh, the humanity.
I don't have anything to say to that.
Yes. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about right now, though. We're talking about a different Harry Potter story.
No, a different, equally ridiculous Harry Potter story. So the City of Perth Library in Australia was originally going to have a Harry Potter event kind of for children to, you know, encourage them to come to the library more.
Yeah.
It was basically advertised for witches, wizards and muggles aged 12 to 18. But no, they've had to replan it because adult fans have complained that they should be allowed to go as well.
Okay.
Like, one of them wrote, my car is Harry Potter themed with a Harry Potter license plate. They've grown up with Harry Potter and are absolutely devastated.
I have a question.
It's a series of children's books.
Hmm. I have a question, right? They grew up with Harry Potter, fine. No problem with that. The library is for all ages, yeah?
Yeah.
So why not just make it an open event in the first place? I know it's a series of children's books, but you're going to have parents going with their kids, aren't you?
Yeah.
And there's no point in making it 12 to 18 years old. If you just make it an open event, you get more people going to the library. You get parents taking their kids, because kids younger than 12 are fans of Harry Potter.
Yep, I think it's more, you can do like a targeted event for 12 to 18 year olds.
True. And besides, the adults who were complaining that they didn't get invited, just make your own convention.
Yeah, or, here's an even better idea, get over it, you whiny, self-indulgent adult children.
And you said my comments about James May and the Top Gear guys was cruel.
Yeah, no, but this is a hard truth they need to learn.
Yeah, true. Well, that was a hard truth that they need to learn as well, but yeah. Random imaginary
people. Plus, I think
people.
If I've studied defamation, I haven't defamed a specific individual.
Yes, this is
therefore
true.
We're not liable. That's suck true. It, Harry Potter fans.
This is true.
Go crawl back under your invisibility blankets. Have a good long cry.
Yes, with your pet rock. Oh no, it's a stone of immortality.
Exactly. And conveniently is also their only friend in the world.
What, the snitch? See, it sounds like a prison movie when you... I caught the snitch. Really? So how are you going to get the information out of it? We're going to take him to the washroom. We're going to give him a good beating with the soap on a rope.
Oh, you want Big Larry to show you his magic wand?
Yes. You're a wizard, Larry. Oh. There's a starfish in the rock pool.
I was just just think this puts Hagrid in a whole new light.
Yes, it does. Anyway, shall we move on
but
to...
Yeah. God, I don't like people like this.
Yeah, I agree with you on this. They really need to grow up a little bit. I mean, choose life. Choose a job. Choose big TV.
Yeah.
And wherever else Irving Welsh
said. The idea that being a fan of something suddenly makes you entitled to everything.
Yeah, but isn't that the typical kind of obsessive, compulsive fan that we've come to know and hate?
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, right, we see it in comic books, we see it in sci-fi TV, we see it in anime, we see it in video games, we don't see it in manga.
Which is weird.
Outside of Japan, you don't really see obsessive compulsive fans when it comes to manga.
I guess it's probably because manga still isn't that large outside of Japan.
The sad thing is, you're right, and manga has so much to offer. So much more than anime does, because anime is like this compartmentalized thing, and it's all this title or this title or this title. We only get a fraction of the anime that gets released every season. But with manga, we get all sorts. We have shelves in comic book stores that are creaking with manga that are interesting, if nothing else. I mean, you would never have picked up Princess Jellyfish.
No, Princess Jellyfish is not something I would have read of my own volition.
Exactly. Unless
I feel like Princess Jellyfish.
Just the last page as well.
You know, I'm technically a man.
And then the little kids. Look! I showed that to Rob as well. He was creasing up. Because it's the kind of thing that Rob probably would have done when he was a kid as well.
It's going to look lesbians.
Yes. Well, it's the kind of thing that most kids would do. I'm pretty sure I would have done the same thing. Pretty sure you would have done the same thing.
Definitely.
Right, okay. So, shall we take a break there and come back with some books? Right. We'll be back in a moment.
The world of comics and manga are much, much more complex than I'll ever know. So tune in to 4Panel on the Geek Show Podcast Network to make that whole world a little less intimidating.
And welcome back to Literary Loitering. I remember the name of the show we're doing.
Yes.
Okay, so...
Unlike me, who was looking for totally the wrong news.
Yes. Yes, you found us some great manga news this morning for the show.
Yeah, I know, and I can't use it.
No. Anyway, now we are going to talk about what we've been reading. So, Rob, you've read an actual book.
Yes, I did. I read The Secret History of Dina Pilgrim, which is one of the Powers books by Brian Michael Bendis and Neil Clyde. But the actual comic series was done by Brian Michael Bendis, and the art was done by Michael Avon Oeming, and that was out on Image Comics. There's a TV series based on the comic book series, and it's a very, very odd police procedural set in a world of superheroes.
Yes, I believe I've read a little bit of Powers, but not much. But which I mean like an issue.
Yeah.
But it seems pretty interesting.
Basically, the idea is that there was the Powers virus, and then people start getting powers, you know, superhero powers, and people were going a little bit crazy with their powers. So the police forces all over the world had to do something to combat the rise in superpowered crime. So they had like a superpowered division within the police force, but superpowered divisions in police forces and military and stuff like that don't always work out. So what you eventually had was the main characters of Powers, who were Dina Pilgrim and Christian Walker. And they were two police officers who had powers before but no longer had powers. And doesn't really go into what their powers were until later on in the book. Christian's powers, you actually learn a lot about within like the first couple of chapters, but Dina's you learn about a bit later on. But this is all about Dina Pilgrim. It's an interesting thing. She's a major character in the comic book series and in the TV series, and it's an interesting look at her actual origins. Now, the book jumps around in time a lot. Each chapter is basically a specific point in time, and sometimes those points in time follow on from each other, but it depends on who's been in the previous chapter. For example, one of the chapters ends with Dina meeting an old friend of hers called Aaron Boucher, and he is there because he's part of some kind of internal affairs thing. and he's there to question Christian Walker, who's Dina's partner. And he's there at the police precinct to question Christian Walker about the events that happened in Atlanta, because very early on in this book, you find out that the powers figure that is most associated with Captain America has been brutally murdered.
Oh, the Captain America XP.
He's basically called Citizen Soldier.
That's certainly a name.
Yes, it is. But he has been murdered, and the way he's been murdered, he's been tied to a chair, he's been beaten with his own shield.
Ooh.
And they're not sure what's going on, but then they find a tattoo on him. He's had this tattoo for a while, they think. It may have been a new job, may have been an old job, but the tattoo is a message. And the tattoo is of an anti-powers hate group called the Human Front. It's kind of like, you know, the people who hated the mutants in X-Men.
Yeah, the thingamajiggles.
You know exactly who I'm on about.
Yeah, yeah, kind of they don't like the concept of people with superheroes.
Yeah. And the hate group, the Human Front, see...
Also, surely they should have been called the Human League.
Yeah, I know. The theme tune should have been Don't You Want Me, Baby. But anyway, so Citizen Soldier is dead, and Christian, who's known him for years, Christian has known Citizen Soldier for a long time. So Christian immediately recuses himself. Well, he doesn't immediately recuse himself from the case, but the captain says, look, you're too close to this. You two were friends. Dina is given command of the case along with a baby-faced noob on the police department.
Well, Rob, I think you mean Friends of Humanity. And then we'll edit that bit in later, so yeah. It looks like I'm not a moron.
No, I'm going to leave it like that. Anyway, so Dina is given the case, and she has to babysit a new guy in the police department called Kirk. And Christian has to meet with Aaron Boucher, who is the IA guy. And he's questioning Christian about the events of Atlanta 12 years ago. And when was the last time he met Citizen Soldier? All sorts of things like that. And then Dina walks in. And her and Aaron are old friends. And the two of them really still have a thing for each other. So Christian's reading the mood in the room and going, okay, let's excuse ourselves. Kirk, who's a baby-faced little detective, he is totally new, can't read the room at all, going, I want to work with Dina. Christian just drags him out of the room.
Damn rookies.
And then it cuts to years ago, 12 years earlier, and... basically how Dina first realized that she actually had a massive crush on Alan Boucher from 12 years ago, because he was a rookie cop and she was still a teenager and she was full of vim and idealism. And this was in Atlanta, which is why Aaron is questioning Christian about the events of Atlanta 12 years ago. So this all ties together in one kind of complex narrative. And the thing is, Brian Michael Bendis, or The Bomb, as we've taken to call him, he does this really, really well. He weaves this complex narrative very, very well, and it keeps you interested in finding out what happens next. It's a very good police procedural and a very good murder mystery, because it doesn't do the typical thing of laying the breadcrumbs for you to follow. But what it does, not in the typical kind of Hansel and Gretel trail, what it does, it lays the breadcrumbs through time instead. Through time in different places. So different events actually lead into events that happen in the present day. And what you eventually see are the threads of these events from the past and how they've led to this point in the present. And that's something that's actually quite complex to do. Tracing it back to, say, 12 years, 20 years, 50 years in the past and saying, okay, from there we have a line going from this event here directly to Citizen Soldier dying in this room. Being beaten to death with his own shield. How do you get from there to there without upsetting the balance of the story and without giving away who the killer is and why?
Hey, cool. I'm glad to hear that, because I think Bomb, he can be a very good writer.
When he wants to be.
Yes.
We've read some of his other stuff as well, which is why he is The Bomb when he writes good. He is Da Bomb when he writes something bad.
Yeah. Well, when he sometimes bombs it.
Yes.
Age of Ultron. Age of Ultron wasn't good.
Age of Ultron was not good. But Powers is an interesting franchise, and I actually really enjoyed this book. I had a problem when I was doing the Aliens trilogy with the descriptive nature that the author was using, because the author was basically using expletives as just a standard.
Wait, no, it wasn't. It was Dave versus the Monsters, wasn't it? Not the Aliens trilogy.
No, it was the Aliens trilogy.
Was it?
Yeah.
I don't know. All these books you talk about, they get mixed up.
Yeah, and the author was using expletives as a descriptive term, and it wasn't from the character's perspective. It was basically the author simply using it straight as a descriptive term. Bendis uses a similar thing, but it's very clearly marked that Bendis is using it from the character's perspective. So what you see, the way you see the world, is as if you're seeing it through the eyes of Dina Pilgrim, who is basically the primary character of the book, or through Christian Walker's eyes. It's not that they're having this internal monologue. It's not that they're describing it in loving detail, because that would just be stupid.
You know? Yeah, but it's like they're a prism through which you're seeing the world.
I like that phrase.
Thanks. Yeah. I was quite smugly proud when I thought of it.
You look smugly proud right now.
I'm going to smugly and magnanimously take a sip of my Vimto.
I've got to say, with this, the dialogue is really good. And that's one thing that I think Bendis does really well, is dialogue.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's got all the hallmarks of something that I would actually enjoy seeing on TV. I've seen like 2 episodes of the Powers TV series, and it's surprisingly good. I am actually going to be sitting down and watching the rest of it, but this manages to capture some of the essence of the TV series without actually diluting it. Because one of the things in the TV series and in the comic is they don't really go into the history of Dina Pilgrim. But this is kind of an essential then if you're a Powers fan.
Okay, cool, because you don't often get these tie-in books, which are actually an important part of the franchise.
Yeah. Well, so I mean,
it's interesting to see them actually do something this essential to the plot.
Yeah. I mean, this basically talks about Dina's history, why she thinks the way she does, and the fact that as a 24-year-old detective who's partnered with one of the most experienced detectives on the force, his world weariness goes back a lot further than anybody realizes, because Christian Walker is a character who's been around for centuries. He's basically seen the rise and fall of humanity several times. And there's only a couple of people who know that he's been around. Even he doesn't know exactly how old he is. He's had various superhero identities. He earned his surname Walker because he literally walked all over the world.
Cool.
And there's nobody who really understands that. Dina is one of those people who has got close to him because she's his partner. As any good cop does, he's opened up to her a bit, and she's adopted certain of his habitual behaviors. So his cynicism, his world weariness, things like that have rubbed off on the young Dina, who was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed originally, but now she's just world-weary and cynical.
Nice. I do like being my world-weary cynics.
Yeah, and she is very, very good as a cynic. Just an example of the writing style in this, right? And the banter that goes on between Dina and Christian Walker, because they've been partners for several years now, and they understand each other in a way that partners do. So they've just found the body of Citizen Soldier, or Joe Monroe is his real name. And Christian's just kind of, he's tearing up a little bit. But Dina's doing this weird thing that she does. She's trying to cope with it in her own slightly cynical, sarcastic way. Dina gestured toward Joe's mashed face. Killer used the shield in a fit of irony. Caves in skull, leaves him for dead. We make a list of known enemies, SOP. Walker set his jaw. More to it than that. Don't overthink it, Walker. Even me with my new school sarcastic sensibilities, even I have mad citizen soldier knowledge. Could name 5 suspects just off the top of my head. She ticked them off with her fingers. Captain Korea, boom! 1. The Tet offenders, zing, that's 2. The Klux Klan crew, Dr. Diabolical, Hoshi Grin. Those are just from the comics, mind you.
Hoshi Grin?
Yes. About the dialogue.
Yeah, like it's very snappy.
Yeah. And just when they find the tattoo with the THF on it, Dina nodded intrigued. Yeah, with the lightning and... But THF? I don't... A name? A relative? Nope, let us go with the fist, and to be honest, the snakes. He lightly slapped his cheek, grimacing and squinting. Ah, damn it, Joe. Is this a lead? Dropped both his hands between his knees and looked Dina's way with a tired, expectant stare, waiting for her to finish. I got it, yes. Tense hero friend. Boom. Dina grinned and faced her partner, softening her eyes when she caught his annoyed expression. Because you're the friend, this way you're involved. No, don't thank me. You done? For now. So, THF? The human front.
I could wait. Sounds really fun.
It is. It really is. And when she gets told she has to babysit Kirk, she goes up to her and goes, you, 6-year-old, you're with me. And that's the kind of way the dialogue works. And that's why it's such an enjoyable read, because the characters have personality. They make you want to read more.
Yeah, I definitely get that.
So, yeah. Anyway, Powers, recommended read for anyone who's a fan of Powers, the comic book, or a fan of Powers, the TV series, or just wants an introduction to either.
So this doesn't require any real pre-knowledge of the show or the comics to get into?
It's nice if you have that pre-knowledge, but you don't need it. Because I have very little pre-knowledge of Powers, and I love this. I think it's really enjoyable.
Good stuff.
So, yeah.
Which... I think I'll probably have to explain this for the less on-point members of our audience. This is a book about Shakespeare. Okay, I'm done. I think I've pretty much explained it. But yeah, this is another kind of a light textbook is how I would describe it.
Light textbook?
Yeah, like it's basically a textbook, but not as maybe in-depth and as heavy reading as that would imply. So this basically starts off, gives a little biography of, you know, who Shakespeare was.
Yeah.
Which, like, a good 40% of is just, and then he did a thing we don't know because there's no record of it. Also, I forgot the hilarious point that his wife was called Anne Hathaway.
Really?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Shakespeare married Catwoman.
You lucky, lucky devil. Hang on, that means Shakespeare was Batman.
Shakespeare was Batman.
No, he wasn't Batman. He was the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Oh my god, this is a film we need. Shakespeare was secretly the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Why not?
Like, I'm surprised no one's made that kind of film.
Shakespeare is the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Like, I'm sorry, if we can get a film where, like, Edgar Allan Poe tries to solve a murder.
Yeah.
We damn well should have Shakespeare was the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yes, I agree.
This, yeah, like I said, it starts with, like, a short, you know, few pages biography of who Shakespeare was. Then it goes on to, basically, a run-through of all of his plays. I like that they've actually split it up into the stuff he wrote for Queen Elizabeth and the stuff he wrote for King James, was it?
Yeah.
Which I think that's a nice way to do it. And each one, it's got a rundown of the play. So it's like it's got like a little timeline of the play, breaking it down to what each of the acts are, as well as a little plot summary.
Yeah.
And then on the page afterwards, it goes into more detail. So if I can just find the page. Basically, you've got a little sidebar, which is in context, where it goes through a list, some of the themes. So I've got the Othello one here. The themes are jealousy, loyalty, betrayal, and love.
Yeah.
The setting is 16th century Venice and Cyprus. And then what I really like is it goes into sources that inspired the play. So you've got Un Capitano Moro in 1565, which is the Moorish captain, which is, you know, obviously the main thing that inspired it.
Yeah.
But then also historical events, like in 1600, the arrival of a Moorish delegation to the Elizabethan court. And in 1603, the 1570 Turkish attack on Cyprus. And then it also lists, the legacy of the play. So kind of how it's been adapted and shown on stage. So you've got 1604, which is the earliest recorded performance of Othello.
Yeah.
Then 1660, Margaret Hughes plays Desdemona, becoming the first woman to perform legally on the English stage. 1816, Gioachino Rossini's opera Othello, loosely based on the Shakespeare play, opens in Naples. Then you've got, I think one of the most interesting bits is 1825, Ira Aldridge is the first black actor to play Othello on the London stage. And then you've also, off to one of the sides, got actually a little biography about Ira Aldridge.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So basically, he was born in New York in 1807, became the first black actor to be Othello, toured about until he died in Poland in 1867.
Wow.
Which I like that it goes, gives you that extra detail as well.
Yeah.
And kind of in between those two sidebars, you've got basically a bunch of things that goes more in depth into what some of the themes are, kind of who some of the characters are as well.
Sounds really good.
So yeah, I've got to, I really like this book.
As a reference book, it's kind of essential then, isn't it, when it comes to Shakespeare? Because there's so much Shakespeare that you could go through. And if you wanted to somewhere to start off.
Yeah, that's what, because I know we've talked a lot about this stuff, about the problems of, you can find a lot of things on the internet now.
Yeah.
But I think for some fake Shakespeare, this really helps as giving you that starting point.
Yeah.
So like I said, it's not hugely in-depth, but it's a really nice starting point, just so you can get an overall overview of what the plays are.
See, I think that the Shakespeare one probably works better than the Sherlock Holmes one we did last week, because the Sherlock Holmes one, part of the nature of the Sherlock Holmes stories is that it's a mystery. So you read it to find out who the killer is. But if you're basically reading what each book is about.
Yeah, then it's going to spoil the ending.
Yeah, you basically spoil the ending. Is there any point in going back and reading the books then? Whereas with the Shakespeare plays, it's not that straightforward. It's not a simple case of who done it.
Yeah.
I suppose you'd say.
I think in a way this can even enhance the plays, because yeah, you can read this and then you can go back with like this knowledge of what the themes are, look at the plays and go, oh yeah, I see how this works within the context of this scene.
Yeah. I mean, the Sherlock Holmes book did go into some of the thematics of each story, but it's still very much a whodunit. It's still very much a, we have to solve this murder. We have to solve this crime. We have to find where the diamonds are hidden. That sort of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, like, not to do Arthur Conan Doyle a disservice.
Because he did some amazing... Yeah. He did The Lost World.
Yeah, but I think a lot of his Sherlock Holmes' books, they weren't that concerned with, like, big overarching themes or anything.
No, they weren't.
It was more just, this is a cool detective guy. Watch him solve mysteries.
While having a massive opium addiction.
Yes. The real final Sherlock Holmes story is just him revealed to be like just a homeless guy in a gutter, rambling to everyone who comes past.
Yeah. It's strange
I'll tell you about the time I fought the Hound of the Baskervilles. just give me some more opium.
So he's Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
I thought you would have said that.
I know. I can't believe I didn't even make that jump.
I was actually waiting for you to say it. And then when you didn't say it, I thought, I've got to say it now.
I'm disappointed in myself.
Yes. Yes.
So like surely on a subconscious level, I must have been aware of that joke to make the setup.
Well, I mean, when you look at Holmes, it's like you're literally just missing one S.
Yes.
Sorry, an E and an S.
Well, that was the whole point of, like, the TV show House.
Yeah, true. No, the point of the TV show House was to confuse six-year-old girls when they want to play House. Because now you can play doctors and nurses and House at the same time.
It's time to play House. Who wants the Viking addiction this week?
Yes, who wants to be the abused interns? Anyway, so... The Shakespeare book. You think it's a recommend?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, if you're interested in Shakespeare, like, so basically, if you're interested but don't know that much, I would definitely recommend it. Like, if you're properly up on your Shakespeare, you probably want something a bit more in depth.
Yeah. But for somebody who's not familiar with Shakespeare.
Yeah, this is definitely a good place to start.
Okay. So. That's our books for today.
Yep, we're done with the books, but now we have a game.
Yes, we're going to play a game, and we're going to do this together, because I don't know what the answers to this are either. Or either.
Okay.
How do you say it? Is it either or either?
I think it's...
Or should we just call the whole thing off?
It's either or either.
I don't know. Let's just call the whole thing off.
That was a song reference, well done.
Yes, it was. I had to say it twice before you got it.
I know, I was too busy actually thinking about what the right one is.
So, today's quiz is 10 questions on stage directions. And what we have to do is match the stage directions to the play. And we'll choose the answer by agreement. because I don't know what the answers to this are.
Due to the show lasting for another 2 hours while we bitterly argue over what the right answer is.
Won't last for 2 hours, don't worry. And if anyone else wants to try this one, it is on The Guardian, which is apparently the website of the year, but I disagree because I think ours is.
Yeah, but that's not a biased opinion in any way, shape, or form.
No. It's not a biased opinion based on the fact that I had actually sat there and built the website. I put it together from spare parts with some string.
Dude, it's like the Fallout weapon of websites.
Yes, it is. Anyway, number one, Thunder and Lightning, Enter Devils with Covered Dishes. Is that from The Crucible, Wicked, or Dr. Faustus?
I think it might be even too obvious, but I'd go for Dr. Faustus.
That was my first choice as well. Is that correct or not? It's not telling me.
Hey, best quiz ever.
Oh, we just have to select them and then we basically submit.
We don't get to find out until the end.
So Dr. Faustus, right, okay. Number two, Miriam begins to drag the body towards the open trapdoor. Is that from The 39 Steps, Snake in the Grass, or Fiddler on the Roof? I'm pretty sure it's not Fiddler on the Roof.
That's the one we can get rid of.
I think The 39 Steps, I'd say.
I don't know. Is there a Miriam in 39 Steps?
I can't remember.
But I have no idea what Snake in the Grass is.
So what do you think?
I like The 39 Steps. Let's say 39 Steps.
Okay. She folds some of the clothes she has already ironed and crosses to the bed with them. Is that from Roots, Death in the Maiden, or Look Back in Anger?
D. George Osborne, the biography, the play.
What was that?
I don't know. I assumed that was George Osborne, like, landing on the roof, desperately trying to stop us from revealing his past role as towel refolder.
Yeah. Yes, unfortunately, that's not an option.
Oh. What were the actual options again? I've forgotten.
Roots, Death in the Maiden, or Look Back in Anger? I'm thinking Look Back in Anger.
What was the character's name?
Can't remember.
I'll agree. Look Back in Anger as well, then.
As they stare guiltily and dumbfounded, the curtain falls. Is that from An Inspector Calls, The Mouse Trap, or Cats? It's Inspector
Calls. Yeah, it's got to be Inspector Calls. That's an easy one.
Number five. They're already talking as the play starts, caught in the middle of a chain of action. Is that from Amy's View, Jerusalem, or Angels in America?
Angels in America.
Okay, Angels in America. I don't have a clue, that's why I'm just going with your answer. Number six, Enter a Messenger with Two Heads and a Hand. Is that Titus Andronicus, The Back Eye, or Media? Or Medea?
Yes.
I'd go with The Back Eye if it's
because Titus Andromachus doesn't have any weird magic stuff in it, does he?
Yeah. Whereas The Back Eye, well, judging from the name, it'd be something to do with the whole Bacchanalian thing, which would have the fantasy creatures in.
Okay, yeah. That sounds like a solid choice then.
Anyway, number seven, Nick re-enters from the hall wearing only underpants and the helmet. Is that East is East, What the Butler Saw, or Avenue Q?
Okay, I'm overwhelming only the helmet. Avenue Q.
Avenue Q. Because I was going to go with What the Butler Saw just for the hell of it.
Because that's What the Butler Saw.
Yes. Number eight. She seems dazed, wanders vaguely, then approaches and grasps the mic. Is that The Rocky Horror Show, Piaf, or Godspell?
Rocky Horror Picture Show, because I've heard of that one.
It's the only one I know that has a mic in, so.
Yeah.
Number nine, the workmen are putting red ribbons on the scaffold. Is that Saved, Soft Cops, or London Road?
I have no idea.
London Road?
Yeah, why not?
And number 10, Exit, Pursued by a Bear.
Yay!
A Midsummer Night's Dream, A Winter's Tale, or Cymbeline?
I don't actually remember which one. I just remember Exit, Pursued by a Bear.
Was it A Midsummer Night's Dream, or A Winter's Tale, or Cymbeline?
Think Midsummer Night's Dream.
You think Midsummer Night's Dream? So I'll put Midsummer Night's Dream, submitting answers. Let's see how many.
No, I've changed my mind about literally every single one of them.
Oh, Dr. Faustus was correct.
Yeah.
And Miriam begins to drag the body towards the open trapdoor with Snake in the Grass.
Ah, damn it.
Yes. She folds some of the clothes she has already ironed and crosses to the bed with them. Was actually Look Back in Anger.
Sweet,
we were right.
Go us.
As they say, guiltily and dumbfounded, the curtain falls was in Inspector Calls. Yep. they're already talking as the player starts caught in the middle of a chain of action was actually Angels in America. Enter a messenger with two heads and a hand was Titus Andronicus.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Because the messenger has the heads of people who are dead.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Damn it.
We done goofed on that one.
Yeah. Oh, no, we goofed on this one as well. We should have gone with this. Should have gone with my choice.
Oh, no, it was what the butler saw.
Yeah, it's what the butler saw. She seems dazed, wanders vaguely, then approaches and grasps the mic. Was from Piaf, not the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And number 9, the workman putting red ribbons on the scaffold was Soft Cops. Number 10, exit pursued by a bear. I was right. It's a Winter's Tale.
Ah, damn it. You should not have let me choose it.
We got 3 out of 10. Hang head and exit stage left, which we shall do right
we
now because we are at the end of the show. So after that exciting adventure...
So, if you've liked listening to us fail horribly at play quizzes, you can find more of us on the internets. We got a shiny website, which we mentioned earlier. It is geekshow.co.uk.
Yes.
You can get in contact at thegeekshow.co.uk with the emails. We are also on Stitcher, we're on Mixcloud, we're on YouTube, and we are coming soon to iTunes.
Yes, we are.
And just finally, we are a voluntary organization. So we rely on the help of our lovely listeners to keep doing these shows, which I think it's safe to say we very much enjoy doing.
Yes, we do.
So if you feel like donating, you can click the donate link on the right-hand side of the website, or you can follow the links on the website to the Geek Shop, where we have lots of merchandise that you can buy. And is cool.
Yes, it is.
And yeah, that's it.
Okay.
That's the blurb.
Right, so we'll be back next week. With more bookiness. You'll have Cthulhu.
I will have Cthulhu.
Yes. There will be Cthulhu next week. Look forward to it. Until then, I have been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.